How's it? You get, what kind of weather do you have in West Texas?
Well, let's see. It's about 18 degrees outside right now, and there's icicles hanging off of my truck.
Well, wow, I guess that's global warming.
I guess so, right?
You wasn't able to watch the Ranting Points there, were you?
No, I just been gathering my stuff for the show.
Okay. Well, interesting phenomena happened last week, Doctor. I was talking to Lori Ditto about her. She visited, was taken to hell several times. And during the course of that conversation, a non-Skype-related issue came up. It sounded as though somebody was breathing on the line. And there was a very subtle sub-voice underneath her voice, as well as distinct, singular breathing voice phenomena in between. And then there were certain sections of the audio where there was complete power loss, but the audio connection was still there, and there was no such thing as that. So I asked her on the show, did she hear that? She just kind of went on. She didn't say anything, but she called me later, said, I did hear that, and I know exactly what it was. She said it was witchcraft. Now, the Bible says that the devil's the Satan is the prince of the power of the air, and as many guesses if I had on the show, including say like her name is Klosky. She can't remember her first name, but she said that she was looking for UFO. Chase Klosky. She was looking for
Chase,
UFOs. When she was looking for UFOs, all the power drained. I mean, it seems that people continue to say when there's demonic activity and they're trying to manifest, they look for power. Is that anything you know about?
Well, yeah, it's not a it's not outside the realm of their characteristics because they have to manipulate matter and energy somehow in this realm to be able to manifest. The first taste of that we get is actually with the Watchers, in the case of the fallen angels landing on Mount Hermon. They appear as anthropomorphic, as human-like, but they're, the descriptions that we have of angels in the Bible are not really anthropomorphic, or at least they're minimally so, because they have all these other, multiple eyeballs and animal traits and wings and things like that. And so, because they appeared as people in our realm, that's a good indication that they're manipulating matter and energy somehow. And yeah, you hear all kinds of cases, in terms of anecdotal data from people who have been or deliverance ministers and exorcists, and even people who have been demonized themselves, of rooms going cold, or strange electrical problems happening. Those are correlations. Those aren't incidental. So yeah, I think that there's mounting evidence. I mean, not that there's necessarily a reason to quantify this stuff, but it is quantifiable to a degree.
Well, that's interesting you say that. I was ghost hunting, I guess you could say, in a graveyard, okay, in the middle of the night, and my two sons were there, and we knew that if we were going to hear an EVP on our electronic device, that we needed to eliminate all electronic apparatus, i.e., cell phones. So we turned them all off and put them in the car, locked the car, and when we came back, the phones showed that each phone called the other while they were off. And
How strange.
that is, well, it is strange. And I thought that happened several years ago, but then recently that actually happened with my wife. I called, showed that I called and I didn't. But and I don't have any outgoing calls. But it does seem that there is a necess it's necessary for demons to gather power. But when you say they manifest, it's sort of like with wings or maybe in an animal form, some bizarre form. It seems like that would take more power, really, than a battery pack from a camcorder, would it?
Well, and I think that that does, and in the cases where they show up like that, they're closer to their otherworldly form, their original form, because the example that I used from biblical passages talking about the sort of theriomorphic or beast-like attributes of angels. That's the original state. That's their natural state. When they come here, they're basically breaching a dimensional barrier, and they have to because of the physics of our realm, as I understand it, they have to draw energy from it and manipulate it, and their appearance is such, you know, that we get here. And that's kind of what I've been working on the last few years is well, what are the varieties of these forms that we find through our folklore and our history, you know, and that sort of dovetails into what I'm dealing with in terms of vampires and werewolves and chimera and things like that, because they show up in ancient records and even beyond, even when we weren't writing, you know, they show up on cave paintings and, you know, these creatures that hover at the edge of our nightmares, basically. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Represent a kind of shared experience.
Well, let me ask. That's a good point. I want to segue to. Can sure. our dreams power a manifestation, or can they access our dreams and use it as power to open a dimensional portal that they can just walk into and be that which we just dreamt?
Well, I think that they do use. You know, they can use our dreams. You know. That is certainly I should be careful how I state this, but that's certainly the implication that we get even from the Bible, and it's fleshed out more in the New Testament. But yeah, when you consider, well, take night terrors for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a medical condition. You know, called night terrors, but mm-hmm. in centuries past it was called old hag syndrome. Mm-hmm. Because people felt like they were paralyzed and that there was some entity that was sitting on top of them. To me, that yeah, there certainly can be an element of the disease there, but it seems to be married with something demonic too. And so I think that that's an example of how these entities are able to if the opening is there, mm-hmm. To take advantage of our dream states.
Mm-hmm. Now, I met somebody who said they had the classic old hag. They sure. said they got up in the middle of the night and there was a woman sitting on their couch. And the people that told me that they don't listen to the Edge, so they wouldn't even know about the old hag. They just said there was this old lady there and the woman actually thought that it was her husband's mother. So he asked him, is that your mom? Did she come in our house? He said, no, my mom's not. I don't know if she was alive. Definitely didn't come in our house and went down. Of course, nobody was there. What is it about this old hag freak that shows up? Is it supposed to scare people?
Well, of course it's supposed to scare them. You know, one of the prevalent emotions today, because of all the divisiveness, especially in the United States, but you could also say globally, one of the most pervasive emotions is fear. And I've done a lot of research on what I believe is the demonic origin of fear, going all the way back to gods like Pan, from which we derive the word panic. And I believe Pan's original identity was the fallen angel Azazel. Mm-hmm. Some of your followers may be familiar with some of my work on Bania, Caesarea Philippi at the foot of Mount Hermon, but that was essentially built as a shrine to the god Pan. And so, yeah, there's a purpose in all of this. I was on a show last week, and we were sort of fleshing this out, and the way that the demonic realm works is that it takes what God gives and turns it on its head. You know, everything is a counterfeit. You know, it's a shadowy reflection of what God offers. And so if God is offering, you know, justice and mercy and love and forbearance, then the demonic is taking, using, abusing, frightening, not comforting. Mm-hmm. So it's their modus operandi.
Well, okay, so that's one of the traits that you know that you can see, I guess. Mm-hmm. But there's something called the power of love, and I'm thinking there's also something called the power of fear. It does seem that the supernatural realm, the demonic realm, operates off this fear. And there's been lore like that, that they kind of feed on that. So is it possible that that an angel, say, if you got all kinds of love in your heart and you're being attacked by a fear-based demon, that the angel would manifest? Could you get an angel to manifest if you had enough love? Because it certainly seems that if there's enough fear in the thing, you're going to see some kind of freak enter into this realm, whether it be a Bigfoot, a nutcracker, or what?
Well, I mean, calling on help from God, from Jesus, is, you know, that basically puts the angelic host at our, I don't want to use the word disposal, but you know, that sort of aid is going to be sent in. The cavalry is going to be sent in if you call for it, basically. Mm-hmm. You may not be able to see them. Some people do. You know, there, again, just like there are all kinds of accounts of demonic manifestations, people, you know, around the world claim to see angelic beings, you know, by their bedside when they're sick, or, you know, if they have a fever, or, you know, in a near-death experience, you know, somebody comes by and gives them, you know, some money, and then they turn around and the person's gone. They can, you know, these sorts of stories pervade our experiences, our culture, going back for centuries. Mm-hmm. And so they can certainly manifest. We know that they do in the Bible. People, you know, see them as just other men, but they point out that, you know, they're part of the heavenly hosts, and they're immediately, you know, they're immediately reverent. So they can, obviously they can manifest. You know, and there's the adage in the New Testament about, you know, entertaining angels unaware.
Let me ask something. And by the way, let me just do a little housekeeping here. So we have three polls up on our website right now on the left side. One of them is, which monster are you most concerned with? And then the second one is, do you believe that demonic activity is on the rise? And those are two there. I can't remember what the other one is. But as we're talking about monsters, so hopefully people take those polls and we'll see where they stand on that. And by the way, Doctor, I got a link to your YouTube. So people will click on your, it's in your bio section. If they click on your YouTube, they should subscribe. We need to get you more subscribers.
Sure. Yeah. It's been growing. And I've had a lot of fun building it. I didn't quite know exactly where it was going to go, but if people want to learn more about that, that's a great medium to do it through. And yeah, I'd appreciate any support. So, you know, if you guys like the content, just come on by.
Okay. So right now in our What Monsters Are You Most Worried About? Okay. It's a tie between... wait a minute. It isn't a tie. It looks like Nutcrackers. No, it's a tie between the Dog Man and Nutcrackers. Now, I got to tell you, Judd, people that know me know that I can't stand Nutcrackers, okay? I believe with their big gnarly teeth, they get up in the middle of the night. If they're like they're by your Christmas tree, you know that. I've told you. It's, they're going like that. So anyway, so then the rest of them, we got werewolves, shadow people, the X got 11%, incubus, succubus, and ghost. And then the let's go to demonic activity. The second question there is demonic activity increasing? And right now we've got... Well, I kind of slid in one. I said, demons stole the election. So I guess that means from the viewer's point of view, demonic activity is. But that's where I want to go with this. You're talking about how society is right now. It's this massive conflict, constant conflict of attacks. Is this giving rise to and unleashing and empowering demonic portals to cause more demonic activity? And that's why I put that poll question in there, but because it seems to me if that is empowering, then it looks to me like hell could be literally unleashed in this country.
Well, I think certainly we're at a point now in society where postmodernism has basically eroded any sort of objective truth, and that's bad morally and ethically, because once you begin to erode that stuff, then anything, any sort of behavior, you know, is tenable, let's just say. Now we're really sort of dealing with the consequences of that now. You know, just look at this past year and all of the rioting and looting and destructive activity that people thought that they were entitled to, just because of their sense of indignation, which in some cases may have been justified, in other cases not. What has to happen to a person on a spiritual and a mental level to prompt them to take part in this sort of mass hysteria and destroy people's livelihoods, their properties, their own neighborhoods, in the name of toppling what they see, in this case, the constitutional, or yeah, the constitution, our the tenets of our government, basically, to topple that, using this sort of violence. And the sort of epiphenomenon of that is that we're divided, we're extremely polar, not only politically but also socially and culturally right now. Mm-hmm. And just looking at this through the lens of the Bible and the lens of the Spirit, this looks like a divide and conquer mm-hmm. strategy.
Well, it certainly does. And while we're talking about fear, it seems to me there's this push to put people into groups to isolate them so that each individual groups hate other individual groups. So is hate would it give rise to the same type of empowerment of demonic activity as fear would? We talk about fear. What about hate?
I think so. I think it's all food. You know, they feed off of that. And we're starting to see, I mean, what we see in physical real time and space, I think is the, you know, it's the byproduct. It's the epiphenomenon of more demonic activity. Mm-hmm. And again, on the surface, there are elements of this that we can quantify. You know, the Catholic Church is commissioning more exorcists now than it has since the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I talk to people all of the time who are, you know, people email me telling me about their experiences. And so it's very much on the rise. It's been on the rise, I think. And for a lot of people, it's like a vicious cycle. It sort of propels the fear. It's like a force multiplier, mm-hmm. Which is all the more reason I think we need to stay grounded in biblical truths. We need to stay grounded in the classical paradigms, which have been, you know, completely thrown out of our education system. Mm-hmm. Once we began to toss these things aside and treat them as completely relative is when we began to see this sort of social cultural breakdown, which has now led into a massive political breakdown. Mm-hmm. And so although there are political problems on the surface, this is ultimately a spiritual problem, and there are no political solutions to spiritual problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get to a few questions coming in here. This is from Rose. She says, what do you know about them using CERN to open portals for demons or fallen angels?
Well, CERN is an interesting, and I should qualify what I say. I'm not a physicist, but I find physics conceptually very fascinating. And my dad's a big science buff and always grew up with, you know, that kind of stuff around. And so I can handle a little bit. I can certainly understand what's going on, at least on the scientific end. But you also hear lots of weird things coming out of CERN, but not only CERN, but some of the other super colliders around the world too. But the dedication ceremony for CERN that they had a number of years ago was basically just a pagan ceremony.
Kind of like the Super Bowl halftime show.
Yeah, kind of like our Super Bowl halftime show.
Yeah, man,
shows.
I never just figured, what's up with that Hindu god? You know, got 15 different arms going every which way. I mean, you got to scratch which arm you're going to use. I don't know.
Well, that's supposed to be an incarnate. You're talking about the one at CERN?
Yeah.
That's
arms?
Supposed to be Shiva, who is also a god of creation and destruction. That's mm-hmm. that's an avatar of Shiva anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're at the point now to where, you know, with things like CERN, that sharp line that we draw between magic and technology is being erased because of the kinds of things that are being done at CERN. Now, on the surface, they're supposed to be studying the origins of the universe and the Big Bang and things like that by looking at it in microcosm, by smashing these particles together. Mm-hmm. But when you have people like Stephen Hawking telling you that it's probably a bad idea because you might actually create an artificial black hole that could destroy, you know, what is a black hole, but it's a portal to some other place.
Yeah.
Begs the question, what is going on behind the research agenda you're trying to understand the origins of the universe, but what's going on behind, what are the other scientific agendas that we don't know about? Mm-hmm. And I pointed out a moment ago that, you know, this is real kind of childhood's end stuff. You know, that Arthur C. Clarke wrote in that book that to a civilization sufficiently primitive to another, that technology would look like magic. Mm-hmm. And we're really kind of at that point now to where that line is being very much blurred. We've entered the quantum age. We have quantum computing where these computers operate off of qubits rather than the binary system. And they dump their questions literally into another dimension to derive the answer to whatever mm-hmm. question they dump into it. Mm-hmm. Fascinating, but also equally disturbing, I think. And CERN is another example of fascinating work, but equally disturbing because, mm-hmm. again, you hear these stories from people who work there that say that they've seen entities in the vicinity of the complex.
Mm-hmm. When you were talking there, it kind of reminded me of the movie Event Horizon, where, you know what I'm talking about, where the ship goes,
yes.
the ship goes, I guess, into a portal or whatever, but it goes
right
into hell. It goes into mm-hmm. evil, and mm-hmm. that evil transferred into the ship itself. The ship became mm-hmm. evil. So that's interesting that it was just like, say, we would say, well, that person is evil over there, but how do we know that car is not evil, you know, or, you know, your Alexis is not evil? Mm-hmm. We know it is, but I'm just saying, there again, that goes back to sort of getting energy from various sources. And I guess if we could find a source, if we knew they were tapping into the energy, maybe we could cut them off. But I don't know if that's going to be a possible thing. And now somebody talked about this old hag spirit we just mentioned a few minutes ago, Doctor. They said, could that be Lilith? They say Lilith is a classic old hag. Is that something? Does something to do with that?
Sure. You know, Lilith shows up in a number of sources from the ancient Near East. Of course, most people will be familiar with Lilith from the stories about the Garden of Eden, that supposedly, you know, this was one of Adam's wives, and she refused to submit to him, so she was turned into the queen of demons. Mm-hmm. That's apocryphal, but she actually does show up in Isaiah, where she's mentioned in conjunction with these other creatures, the Cherim, who are basically satyrs, like in Greek mythology, like Pan. But she also shows up in the Mesopotamian material as Lilu or Lilitu. And she is not a very nice entity. She's, as I pointed out a moment ago, she's regarded as the queen of demons. But she feeds on infants.
Oh.
And she steals the virility of men. So there is a Lilith archetype that belongs with the old hag syndrome.
Wow. Okay, now I understand. Are you developing a book on Göbekli Tepe?
I am.
What's going on with that?
Well, a good friend of mine and colleague, Dr. Aaron Judkins, had been thinking separately at first. We'd been thinking about doing a book on Göbekli Tepe, which is a site in eastern Turkey that's been making a lot of buzz the last 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody had their take on it, it seemed like. Klaus Schmidt, who was a very capable archaeologist, sort of led the charge with the conventional interpretations. You know, the Ancient Aliens crowd had their take on it. The Ancient Mysteries people sort of had their take on it. And we started talking about it. We were fascinated by the site, and I had been teaching about it in my world civilization classes for over a decade. And we said, you know, nobody's really looking at this through the lens of the Bible. You know, are there any biblical implications? Because that region of eastern Turkey was basically northern Mesopotamia at one time. It's at the headwaters of the Euphrates, which would have been the basically one of the best locations that we have for the Garden of Eden at one time. It's also very near to where the Ark came to rest after the flood. It's also very near to Haran, where Abraham was from. Mm-hmm. And there have been a number of scholars who have argued that Abraham's Ur was not in southern Mesopotamia, like the archaeologist Leonard Woolley pointed out, but was in fact in northern Mesopotamia, close to a modern town in Turkey called Şanlıurfa. And there's a lot of local tradition there about this being Abraham's Ur of the Chaldees. And so there were these overlapping layers of biblical pertinence that Dr. Judkins and I began to look at, and we thought, hey, let's write a book about this. So that's what we decided to do.
All right. We've got a question here from Australian Ben, as you may know, maybe one of our previous guests says, is the Jezebel spirit all pervasive in modern pop music? Is this the cause of hypersexual music videos? And, you know, I did a Ranting Points. I don't know if you've ever watched me do that, but I did it on the Super Satanic halftime show last week. Mm-hmm. And now I don't follow the National Felon League, but I have to do some I have to look at it for intelligence reports. You know, I've got to do some intel on the enemy. Mm-hmm. But that freak, some guy named Week something or Weekend or Week Later or I don't know what week some just week. You know, he's doing a little Michael Jackson, but he only did like a little scoot. It's like you're not even moonwalkers. Don't even try it like you're a Michael Jackson protege. But but the last year, I think what was the last year, you had that woman, I don't know who she was, she come out there sliding and grabbing her crotch, sliding across there like right into the camera with a big crotch grab, and her daughter is like 15 feet away in a cage. I'm thinking, dude, this is sick. I don't know what kind of message these people are trying to portray. But so to his question there about this Jezebel spirit, what kind of damage is that doing to the United States?
Oh, massive damage. For one thing, look at our divorce rate. You know, we're creeping up on 60%. Now, that in itself ought to be, you know, you want quantification. There's some right there, but this sort of hypersexualized lack of moral decency, you know, that gets shoved in our face, you know, the NFL is one example, but it's on everything. Mm-hmm. You really have to be discerning about the kind of stuff that you watch, because it's hard to escape the imagery. You know, it's just, we're just sort of bombarded by it. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, this all goes back to, I think the big turning point for our country, and I do believe that it was demonically influenced, was the postmodern movement coming out of the 50s and 60s, in which you had particularly the 1960s. But, you know, this basically threw out, you know, objective truth, objective mm-hmm. morality, and so we're dealing with the consequences of that right now. Mm-hmm. You know, the so-called sexual revolution, you know, out of the 60s was also, you know, we're also seeing repercussions of that now. So that, you know, you end up with some of the most base, perverse incarnations of programs, like this Cuties program.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Like this Cuties. You know, I got a feeling that Netflix viewership went up with that show.
In some sectors, I'm sure that it probably did.
I know John Podesta probably enjoyed it.
Well, I mean, it just serves to exacerbate the situation, and you know, it's clearly strategic. It's clearly demonic. And again, circling back to the postmodernism issue, mm-hmm. when you erode these basic truths of our society, which are biblically rooted and classically rooted, mm-hmm. then you're going to end up with the proverbial, you know, crap storm. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see that now.
Well, now doesn't every generation make that claim though? I mean, when the Beatles came out with a mop top and maybe one of them's caught smoking a joint somewhere, say that's the end of civilization, our kids are ruined forever. I mean, boy, do we pine for the days when was the worst of it. Now they got their pants falling off, they got tattoos, they got earlobes with like stretched out and pink hair, and they don't know what sex they are. I mean, it does seem like every generation makes that claim, but it seems to me we've got sort of a rightful claim to it in this time, from what I can see. Because right. but I can see, even back in the 50s, you know, when girls stopped wearing dresses to church, because there was a time we didn't, when the girls wore dresses and the guys wore slacks and a tie going to mm-hmm. school. And of course mm-hmm. now you know what kind of mess you got now. So is it just generational thing, or are we in the most decadent, nasty ever?
Well, a lot of the differences that you're talking about might have moral implications, but those generational changes, you know, just looking at it anthropologically, a lot of those are cultural and not necessarily moral. You know, there may be moral judgments placed on them, but you know, if Judeo-Christian principles have been our benchmark since our founding, then I would say that we've moved, you know, considerably more, you know, several orders of magnitude more away from that than the sort of generational criticism that you're talking about. Because you're right, I mean, that happens, you know, with every generation. You know, kids today, you know, back in my day we didn't do, you know, this, that, or a lot of those changes are cultural, that may have moral judgments placed on them, but they don't necessarily represent moral degradation. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're looking at here, and that too I think is quantifiable if people start mm-hmm. to really dig into the sociology and the demographics of the situation.
So back in my day, let's just say I might know some people that threw eggs at cars, passing cars. I don't know who they were. But now they're throwing Molotov cocktails. So can I say that it's a little bit worse?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's the orders of magnitude worse that I'm talking about. I mean, it's one thing to, I don't know, toilet paper a house or something like that, but to destroy somebody's, you know, business.
Okay, hey, by the way, let me interrupt you there, because last week we had Lori Ditto on the program. She was talking about confessing sins and everything. Mm-hmm. And so now something just came to mind. That I'm going to have to.
You feel the need to confess?
I do, doctor. I was doing it last week too. So I was a paper boy in Indianapolis, okay? And so there's these people I didn't like, and so what I did was, it was early in the morning, and I saw this big nasty giant bug. This thing was huge, man. Well, I grabbed him and I put him in the newspaper. And then I put the paper in the door. Am I going to burn for that one?
No, I don't think so. I think as long as you're genuinely sorry about that you probably won't.
Now, where in the heck did that sin come? Where did that come up? See, I don't know. I guess I was affected pretty. Well, listen, while we're at it, you got anything that you got to confess right here?
Well, let's see. There are some cats that frequent my backyard, and I usually throw them some snacks. I didn't do that today.
What?
Yeah, I know. I should have. It's cold.
Now we got starving cats.
Starving cats. What's the world coming to?
Wow. Unbelievable. Oh, wait a minute. Now, people in the live chat say, no, I never did nothing. Like, wait a minute now. Or wait a minute, people in the live chat, just throw something out there, just a little quick thing, easy to read, what you did that you need to confess. And it was and it was good for people's soul. Like that, seriously, the last week's show was pretty good. People were saying, man, I thought some things when she was talking that I don't want to deal with. That I got
to
get out.
I mean, there's a reason that we do that. I mean, you know, it's not only good for us, but you know, it keeps us on the level we need to be with God. You know, it keeps us in the proper place, gives us a proper perspective.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get to another question here. Australian Biz says, good day, Daniel. Looking forward to Judge thoughts on the Black Awakening. Now, I think that is a term that we've heard here by Rush Dizdar. What do you think about that?
Rush Dizdar. Mm-hmm. Oh, I think, you know, there have been people who've called it different things. I think Russ has done a good job of really articulating what exactly that means. You know, and all the various tendrils, you know, that his thesis has, reaching into, you know, our own bureaucratized government and, you know, our PSYOPs programs and you know, just the sort of, you know, weapons research, you know, how all of that ties together with a lot of this. And I think, yeah, I think we're starting to see, you know, elements of that too. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was Russ, I think, that showed me a video clip one time of a couple of girls in England who were running across a freeway, basically, and they both got hit multiple times.
Wow.
And they got back up, like, you know, they were a little disoriented to begin with, but they got back up. And his thinking was that this is an example of the kind of, you know, supernaturally informed genetic manipulation that's taking place right now.
Yeah, a few years ago, there was a big thing of people stripping, getting naked, and running down the freeway, and had superhuman strength. They said it was salt, but I don't really believe that. I'm thinking that was a dark awakening. By the way, we have a confession to report, Dr. Judd, on the chat. They said we put a catfish in a toilet. Now, if we ever, this is going to segue right into the show, which is there such a thing as a chud?
Is this a reference to the what was it, the cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers, right, movie back from the 80s?
Right. Is that where they come from? Because people were putting catfish down toilets.
I don't know that. I couldn't really intelligently comment on.
Now see, that the chud is something I should have put in the monster list, because that people may have some fear about that when they're scared the crap, sure, out of me. All right, here's another question for you from our live chat again from Teflon Coat. It says, Doctor, do you have any contact with angels or spirits?
Well, not directly. The only spirit that I have contact with is God. If I ever feel the need to petition angelic help, it's always through the source. It's always through, mm-hmm, Jesus. The other kind of contact that I have, and I don't consider myself a full-time, you know, deliverance minister, but when I have over the years helped people,
mm-hmm,
the other kind of contact that I would have would be more combative, of course.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so the simple answer is yes. The more complicated answer is it just depends.
Okay. By the way, we have another confession coming in.
Everybody wants to get stuff off their chest today.
You have to. There's a cleansing to it. You know what? This is the thing. If something comes to your mind, you don't put it back down in there. It's coming, yeah, up for a reason, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I've prayed, yeah, to the Lord, and you know, I mean, there's some facetiousness, having a little fun here, but still, I've asked God, said, man, if there's something I've left on the table, let me know. Okay, this person here says,
sure,
I stole extra soap bubble pills for my soap bubble gun. Okay, they stole extra bubble pills for their soap bubble gun. Now that you know, that person just got pulled out of the fire for confessing that one.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anybody else, just throw it. Anybody else got to get something off your chest, just put it in the live chat. By the way, be sure to take the Edge poll question live while we're talking to Dr. Judd Burton, PhD, about what monster bothers you the most on the left side of the website. And then you can ask the second poll question right underneath it, which says, do you believe demonic activity is increasing? And thirdly, be sure to subscribe to the doctor's YouTube channel. Now, Baby Wolf in the UK says that Tom is going to decode the EVP phenomena that occurred on last week's show. And Doctor, I have had during time, now I don't say everything that happens to the show is a demon or demon interference. And I know some people, I know for a fact that some hosts, that, like podcast hosts, their internet goes out and they say, the demonic forces are attacking me. But then they'll go and say, but if you help me out, send a donation so that I can prevent this from happening again. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. Okay.
I don't think that's how it's supposed to work.
No. So I really, you know, and really when it comes to these kinds of phenomena that we're talking about, whether it be werewolves, apparitions, vampires, you have to go through a checklist of some sort, don't you, to say, is my imagination or is this real?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, again, we're so impacted and affected by pop culture. You know, these stories have made good fodder for all kinds of movies and books and entertainment. And our pop culture is rife with all kinds of series on vampires and werewolves and zombies and witches. And so it's sometimes difficult for people to sort of strip away the literary or the television or cinematic veneer, you know. In other words, you know, don't think Bela Lugosi or Frank Langella or Christopher Lee when you think of vampires. As entertaining as those guys were, you know, think of this as a demonic entity, as a real demonic entity that people have experienced all over the globe in various shapes and sizes and forms. And the stories that remain are representative. And I, you know, again, looking at this through the lens of anthropology, these stories were preserved for a reason. They still continue to have functions within those societies as cautionary tales, as moral deterrents, and I would add that they represent real experiences and real space and time that these people had with something supernatural. Now, plug that into the biblical worldview, and you immediately get the sense that these things don't have the best interest of their interactors or victims, as is usually the case. They don't have their best interests at heart. And the research that I've done over the last several years, and I've spoken about this at conferences, and I've got a perspective book on tap, and I just developed a new certification coursework module that people can learn about these things. But the research that I've been doing ties all this back into the pre-flood world, because you see a lot of the blueprints for things like vampires and werewolves and even witchcraft and zombies and things like that in the activity that's going on in the pre-flood world with the Watchers and the Nephilim. The disembodied spirits of the Nephilim are described as being bloodthirsty. They were bloodthirsty in their life. They were bloodthirsty as spirits, and they're always looking to inhabit. They carry with them the legacy of all of this not just practical knowledge, but occult knowledge that the Watchers taught humanity in exchange for genetic access to them. And so, again, when you have to strip away the cinematic, you have to take the European nobleman and the fake fangs away from these creatures to begin to take them seriously. And, you know, it takes it takes that leap, I think, to begin to look at them past the cinematic, because we're so conditioned by our popular culture to think about them.
There is the cinematic aspect of it, but I think we're also discussing that there's a reality to some of these
things.
Doctor, when somebody is saying, let's say they have a chronic illness, and then they have another illness, and then financial things hit, and then some family member or something happens to them, when there was a cascading amount of events, at what point should that person stop looking for chance and, you know, other natural factors? At what point should they look at supernatural factors being the source of their troubles?
Well, if that person is walking with the Lord, then multiple occurrences like this should tip you off that this is, you know, this might not be incidental. This is probably demonic. And, you know, we also have to remember that there are times that, you know, God allows us to be tested by those kinds of trials. Mm-hmm. So it takes a good deal of discernment, I think, and no small amount of prayer to be able to make that decision.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, Chuck Bam says people are seeing an increase of the dog man apparition, which is one of our monster questions. Mm-hmm. Doctor, is there such a thing as a dog man?
I think with all the accounts of dog men, I think they belong under the larger umbrella of were creatures, you know, werewolves. Ooh. And were hyenas and things like that. So it doesn't surprise me that they're starting to crop up in larger numbers, because quite frankly, they've existed, you know, again, going back to the pre-flood world, and probably, you know, at that point when the Watchers are creating these chimerical creatures, they're mixing human genetics with animal genetics, you know, and we live with the legacy of that, you know, even to this day. And there's an excellent book by Sabine Baring-Gould called The Book of the Werewolves. And Montague Summers, the Reverend Montague Summers, who was a brilliant classical scholar, wrote on a number of topics like vampires and werewolves. He also wrote a very good book on werewolves. I would probably recommend Baring-Gould's book first, but this will give people a broader idea of where the dogman lore really begins, within the context of not just old world folklore, but there's a lot of, in the case of the dogman, we're talking about the folklore of the Americas, the indigenous mm-hmm. Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, every time you say lore, to me, you're saying imaginary or story time, but I'm thinking there's some real thing. I mean, out at the Skinwalker Ranch, they had dog man apparitions identified by tribal police.
So right, exactly. And I'm not saying, yeah, I'm using words like lore and mythology, but that doesn't mean that I'm discounting the reality, because even those words like myth and folklore have been hammered into us as you know, they're synonyms for fancy and falsehoods and lies and things like that. But that's, you know, you take them back to their etymological roots. Like the word myth is from the Greek word mythos, and it means story. It doesn't mean a lie or fallacy at all. And so we've sort of bastardized those words through, you know, it's really a byproduct of the Age of Enlightenment, you know, when empiricism became the high priority in all disciplinary study. Mm-hmm. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but we live with some of the negative repercussions of that, and some of our words have been mangled pretty harshly because of that. And so when I use words like lore or myth, I'm certainly not discounting the reality of these occurrences. Yeah. It's quite the opposite, in fact.
We got a question for. Oh, this is do I dare say a sin confession? But the viewer says, now who hasn't put a paper bag of dog poop on a porch, lit it on fire, and ran? Now, that doctor, that kind of sounds like maybe you might know something about that. Is that true?
I know nothing. I know nothing about that.
Well, that's the kind of confession I like here. Oh, wait a minute. Here's another confession. Scotty says, when I was like kindergarten, I stole these tickets that you could trade in for pieces of candy and toys. Now, confession is good for the soul. So our monster show has turned into a little bit of confession. Let's get one more for you. It's from Sissy Stone. Old soda machine bottles, I'd carry a can opener, open them, and the soda would drain into a cup. Now, that kind of reminded me, back in the day, I might know a kid delivering his papers that found a Coke machine that could you could reach your hand up in there and grab a Choc-Cola. Now, I think I might have met that kid that did deliver those papers. Have you ever had Choc-Cola?
I don't think I have.
Man, what? You've never... Is anybody here ever had Choc-Cola? I got to know now, because that might be in a different dimension that nobody knows about.
Choc-Cola
was it was a chocolate drink, man. It was a chocolate drink like a Coke, only you get a Choc-Cola, see?
Choc-Cola.
Yeah.
Never had one.
Yeah. Speaking of monsters, man, there's Count Dracula. There's, what was that? The Dracula cereal. Is that
Count Chocula.
Yeah, is that trying to program us there with vampires?
Well, I mean, you know, it's sort of one more thing. Growing up, I ate my share of Count Chocula, but it's just...
And that's how you know, got studying monsters. You ate Count Chocula.
Well...
So which makes you a cannibal, too.
I suppose so. But how can you turn down sugary, marshmallowy chocolate cereal?
Well, you've been exposed as a cannibal, so we got problems here right now. Oh, by the way... We do have several people have had Choc-Cola. Some people say I love Choc-Cola, and of course, like all good things, the man has got to make that company go out of business. I think somebody else took it up and trying to do it again. And speaking of cannibalism, isn't there an uptick in that too as well, Doctor?
Well, you know, I suppose you could say that there is, but again, this is something that's always existed, you know, flying under the radar. And even in, you know, even in our own country, you know, we read about some of the high strangeness that our elected officials get up to, you know, behind the scenes, and the occult rituals that some of them are involved in do involve cannibalism and blood drinking.
What's this spirit cooking business all about by these lunatic Hollywood celebrities and Hillary Clinton?
Well, I mean, again, it's just another piece of the puzzle that shows the spiritual depravity of the elite, not only in our country, but also in other nations, in which you have this sort of, trying to think of the name of the girl who was she was on Smallville. Her name escapes me. She was an actress, but she was basically drafted into this cult to bring these people in so that they would be used for these so-called spirit cooking.
Yeah, I remember the news when it hit. Maybe somebody in the live chat will tell us here he goes. Allison Mack.
Allison Mack, that's
man,
it.
I love the chatters of this show, man. They get me out of so many binds to make me they make me look so good. I just act like I know what I'm saying. I just look over at the live chat and I get the answer. more questions. Okay. Should I learn the difference between flesh and blood and Satan and his army?
Well, if I understand what they're asking, again, that takes discernment, you know, to try and determine, you know, whether you've got a flesh and blood enemy or if there's something, you know, demonic behind the flesh and blood. And again, this kind of stuff takes lots of prayer and biblical study and discernment to be able to make that call.
Why is it that Catholic priests only seem to be the ones doing exorcism? I mean, what the Protestants doing, man? I mean, they're just going around having bean suppers all the time.
Well, I mean, it shouldn't ultimately... I mean, I know that there are purists that say that, you know, only a priest can be an exorcist, but And Catholics and Protestants have different ideas about that, but it should be a believer thing, because we're, you know, when you look at the ministry of Jesus, a good third at least of what he was doing was exorcism, was ministering to the demonized, how, you know, whatever appellation you want to put to that, possessed, oppressed, whatever.
Well, let me ask you about that, doctor. When Jesus cast the demons out of Legion and they went into the pigs, the pigs went off the cliff. That didn't kill those demons, did it? Did he give them a pass?
No.
I'm not questioning what God does, but no, please don't strike me down. Please,
I mean,
don't strike me down.
But they instantly knew, you know, in the passage there, they instantly knew who Jesus was, and they said, "Don't throw us into the abyss," because that's the ultimate. That's what's going to happen to them ultimately, is they'll be thrown into, you know, there are several words for it in the New Testament, Tartarus, hell, Hades.
But the demons, the demons didn't drown, or did they?
No, they were just put into these pig bodies, and the pigs were the things that drowned, but the demons were not destroyed.
Okay, so did they float back up and look for human inhabitants?
They went out looking for other things to inhabit, because that's something that the Bible tells us that they do. And this goes all the way back to the pre-flood world and the judgment that was placed on these disembodied spirits, that they were to wander and thirst and hunger and never be sated, and always look to embody.
Hey, give me
but there's a footnote, interesting theological footnote that I'd like to put to that. That was the first instance of deviled ham in history.
Wow. I think I've had an effect on you, man.
You have.
Wow. That was a good one. Give me a short description of the Rephaim.
The Rephaim were a tribe of giants that, probably the earliest of the tribes of giants that settled in the ancient Near East after the flood. They're mentioned several times in the Old Testament. The first reference to them is in Genesis 14, in a description of a war between a Mesopotamian coalition of kings and a coalition of kings in the Transjordan. And the implication there is that the Rephaim were either some of those kings in the Transjordan, or they were fighting along with those kings against the Mesopotamian coalition. But they're probably the most famous Rephaim in the Old Testament is Og, who was a king of Bashan amongst the Amorites. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things about Rephaim is to be found in its meaning, its name. Rephaim is usually translated as ghosts or wraiths or shades. Ooh. So there's always this connection with Sheol, the Jewish conception of the underworld. Mm-hmm. That this was a widespread concept in the ancient Near East is evident in some of the more recent linguistic studies that have been done in conjunction with the word Rephaim. And it's clear that it shares a common origin with words like the Akkadian, the Mesopotamian word Rab or Rabba, which means prince or ruler, and the very similar Ugaritic word, the Phoenician word Rapa or Rapaumi, which is all of these are phonetically similar to Rephaim, but it gets better because they're also associated with the underworld. This is where the Mesopotamians believed the Apsu, the abyss. This is where they believed their god kings went to when they died. They became rulers of the underworld. And in the Ugaritic material, the Phoenician material, this gets fleshed out because there was an actual funerary cult that honored these long dead kings, these ancestor kings. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I believe that they were the first of the giants to assert themselves, whether they, you know, however they got there. Some people think that there was another angelic incursion after the flood. That's possible. But I believe that these were literally the first kings, the first rulers of civilizations in the ancient world. Because when you look at virtually all early phases, embryonic phases of city-states and civilizations, the people believed that their gods, and their rulers, in fact, believed that they were either gods themselves or representatives of the gods, sort of semi-divine beings, and they were autocratic, oppressive rulers. So almost across the board, and people, scholars without any inkling of faith or belief in a higher power, will tell you that almost without fail, the earliest civilizations were all theocratic monarchies. Their religion and their politics.
Wow, that's
one all in the same boat.
That's one heck of a short answer right there. Hey, let me drag you into controversy, because you don't have enough. Do you eat pork?
I do.
Okay.
How's that for a short answer?
Wait a minute. I thought I was going to get something more than that. I thought I was going to get another, your regular short answer. Okay,
let's get... I don't eat a lot of it, but I do eat pork. Yeah.
Okay. All right. What about the Mandela effect? What's going on there?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that I have an easy answer for that. You know, I think some of it you could probably write off to a kind of mass delusion, but there are other instances that just make you wonder if that's possible. And with all that we know about multidimensionality and the malleability of time space, I find it hard to discount every instance of the so-called Mandela effect. I'm still a little bit out to lunch on it, but I do think that there is something to some of the cases.
Well, I wasn't going to say that, but you I wasn't going to say you were out to lunch. Hey, all right, let's get this question here. So Carol wants to know, Doctor, how do you distinguish between a Nephilim and a Raphaim?
Well, technically the Nephilim were the pre-flood giants. And in the post-flood world, Nephilim becomes a kind of generic term for the giants.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's good enough. Who built all the ancient structures, the pyramids and the Easter Island big heads?
All of them? Are we going to do multiple shows? Because it's going to take a while.
No, short answer. Somebody. Just say, well, somebody. Somebody did.
I think largely the prehistoric megalithic monuments, the early antique megalithic monuments that we have, things like the pyramids and ziggurats and temple structures and the monuments in Mesoamerica that are all sort of pyramidal structures. I think ultimately they were built by humans, but I don't think that human knowledge or technology was used to build them.
Hey, I must be getting hungry. Was there a candy bar named Ziggurat?
I know what you're talking. It was called Zagnut. Zagnut. That's what it was called.
See, there you go. I want one of them. you say, Daniel, you're supposed to be paying attention to what I'm saying. You're talking about candy bars. All right. Is it more likely that than not that many celebrities are fallen angels and they're in the flesh tasked with corrupting humans?
Well, not fallen angels, because there's a difference between fallen angels and demons. The fallen angels are temporary. Let's say that they're just temporarily jailed right now. That's the sense that
that's what it ought to be.
Now we get glimmers of that in the canon, in like Second Peter and Jude especially, but those books draw heavily from books like that you find in the Dead Sea Scrolls, like the Book of Enoch. In fact, they're alluding directly to that. And so the fallen angels are chained, you know, they're in angelic prisons basically right now. The demons, you know, and again, you trace this back to the language that's being used, the words that are being used, let them say what they say. The demons are the disembodied spirits of the Nephilim, those pre-flood giants that we were talking about. They're called unclean spirits in later literature.
Is it ever likely that we'll get evidence of any of these creatures we've been talking about? hard physical evidence, or are they always going to be sort of mystical?
Well, physical evidence is the most difficult one. I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, because I do think that it does exist. But there are really three axes of evidence when it comes to evidence for giants and the Watchers. The first is the mythological oral tradition evidence that we have. And it's easy for us to sort of say, well, they didn't write any of that stuff down, so it's probably not history. Well, that doesn't make any sense, particularly if you're looking at it anthropologically, because we know that there have been multiple cultures who have these redundant cultural mechanisms built into their traditions, so that the accuracy is maintained even without a written language. The Druids, even the Hebrews before they had a written language, had this stuff. The Anasazi in the American Southwest were these amazing astronomers, and they would pass these this information about astronomical events that wouldn't happen for five generations down, and they did it so well that that generation knew exactly when and where to look for them. So that stuff just doesn't hold water. So there's always an element of historicity in the mythological and the oral tradition. And then you have the actual text tradition, which is the second axis. That's the purview of historians, is the written
Did you
material
say
that's left.
historicity?
Historicity.
What the hell is that?
Historicity. It's that's the value, that's the historical value of something.
Oh, okay. All right, go ahead.
And so the text, we've got plenty of text that talks about this stuff. And then, of course, the smoking gun that we all want is the physical evidence. And we find that, sort of piecemeal around the globe. Now, everybody, including myself, wants the articulated skeleton, complete skeleton of one of these giants. And it's been arguable that they've been found in the past. It's just, where is it gone? Some of it's probably been obfuscated purposefully. Some of it is probably still waiting in a museum basement somewhere.
Well, here's what I say about Bigfoot. If he's a myth, bring him to me in a bottle. If he's a monster, bring him to me in chains.
Well, there was a movement, I guess back within the last 15, 20 years or so, to actually find a specimen. And there were members of this group that wanted to find the physical specimen, and they were willing to actually kill to hunt a Bigfoot, to produce the physical specimen. What now, whatever became of that, I don't know, but some people posit that Bigfoot has both spiritual or supernatural and physical attributes. That may be the case, and related to that is a hypothesis that I've had. It's not really a theory because it hasn't been tested, but I think one of the reasons for the paucity of evidence of giants in the world is because you have to remember we're dealing with creatures that have both angelic and human genetics. So you have genetics from another dimension. So it may be that when they decompose, there's an interdimensional component to that, and we can't predict how they physically decompose.
All right. But it does appear that that would fill the gap with a lot of sightings and then disappearances as well.
Certainly.
And again, that goes back to our earlier conversation in the first hour about that there must be for some of these entities to appear that they apparently need to drain power from something, whether it's a camcorder battery, your cell phone battery, your flashlight battery. But it just seems to me it would take more power than that. So, and I would think if you're out there alone and you see an entity, it seems to me that a portal opening is more power than you could possibly carry, unless there's a way that they could magnify that energy, and then create a porthole too. All right, let's get another question. It says, was history erased sometime in the late 1600s and replaced By what we now know as history, does the mud flood theory support this notion?
Well, that's an interesting turning point in the history of the world. You know, around 1600, you're in the West, we're coming off of the Renaissance, essentially. And so there's been this sort of rediscovery of classical sources, and people are sort of, you know, you're right at the point of the beginning of the scientific revolution, basically, mm-hmm. in the 1600s. And then on the heels of the scientific revolution, you have the Enlightenment movement that we talked about a moment ago, which begins in the late 1600s and goes all the way to about 1800. And this is when, as I pointed out a moment ago, that empiricism and rationality begins to become the measuring stick rather than scripture. You know, the church had been the authority on all knowledge and creation up to that point, and now it's gradually being wrested from the church. Mm-hmm. Now, there are good points and bad points about that, but one of the byproducts of that is that by using this completely empirical approach to knowledge, you know, things that seem, you know, that sort of stretch the imagination, like we find in mythology and folklore, but which we believe, you know, are still grounded in reality. For the pure empiricist, those things may be culturally interesting, they may be artistically and literarily interesting, and may have value within that culture, but they don't represent something that actually takes place in reality. Mm-hmm. And so we're sort of, the caller asked, you know, was history erased? Mm-hmm. I don't believe history was erased, but I believe our view, the way that we view history, changed drastically, and that had both positive and negative ramifications.
But isn't history being erased today?
Yeah, again, it's this force multiplier thing today because of the, you know, we went to bed, you know, last week, and then we woke up and it was 1984, you know, not the year, but exactly. Winston Smith and Big Brother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if people are familiar with that book, they know that there's a manual that one of the main characters gets, Winston Smith, from another character, that tells basically the secret history of the world. And like everything that the party, that Big Brother's party, had come up with was basically a rewriting of history, so that mm-hmm. Through the use of the media, through use of the rewriting of books, through the use of the telescreens, you know, that are in yeah. everybody's room, people became conditioned to this new narrative, and it was not true. It was not historically true. It was what the party wanted them to believe. Right. And so, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's already beginning to take. That's been taking place under the auspices of things like Common Core and our public education system. Our public education system in general is not designed to. And we're just talking about history. We're not talking about, you know, you get people who can't count back change to you now as a result of the failures of the public education system.
Speaking of Chimera Creations, are you going to take the vaccine?
Not now anyway. I am very cautious about it because of the way that it was rushed through trials. Mm-hmm. First of all, this is a disease that is, you know, 99.7% survivable. But mm-hmm. I have serious reservations about any drug that is rushed this quickly through mm-hmm. trials, no matter what the conditions, you know, supposed conditions are,
well,
you know,
that are causing it. It's ironic. They seem to have had millions of doses ready to ship out before it was approved. Now you mm-hmm. would think, suppose they didn't approve it. So you got to tweak that a little bit. All those millions of vials, injections going back to the lab and getting adjusted. Something's off here, doctor.
Well, and it's my understanding that the Moderna vaccine is that's the mRNA based vaccine. Mm-hmm. And that one really gives me pause because if people know what messenger RNA does, you know, you have DNA in your cell. And I'm not a geneticist, but I was exposed to basic genetics in the course of my physical anthropology classes, because we studied all kinds, you know, anatomy, morphology, those kinds of things. The way that our DNA works is it's a blueprint. Messenger RNA works off of that blueprint. But now that's our own messenger RNA. Now we've got a foreign messenger RNA in this vaccine that's being introduced into our body. What's it going to do with the basic component parts that are around it? What blueprint is it working off of?
Satan's?
I mean, it's pretty scary stuff, you know. And I'm not saying that, you know, that it's all necessarily nefarious, but it should give people pause, you know, just the conditions.
I'll say it's nefarious. I don't care.
What
are they going to do? Cut my YouTube channel off? Do you know they cut my YouTube channel off on Christmas Eve when I was singing Christmas songs?
You're kidding.
No. And it was karaoke style. Because I thought everybody's stuck in their house. So I thought I'm going to have a Christmas Eve sing-along, you know, some of the classic Christmas. So I was singing White Christmas, and YouTube just cut me right off, said copyright. It was a karaoke song. Okay, and I was thinking I was sounding pretty good, I gotta say. But anyway, they cut me off of that. That was monster right there. Hey, listen to this story just come in. It says, Dr. Burton, several years ago, I was sleeping in my camper. I was sleeping very sound. And in the middle of the night, something pushed me straight up into a seating position and in a daze, wondering why am I like this. And then at that very moment, the outlet next to his bed burst into flames. Do you ever come across stories like that?
Wow. Well, that's a new one. I've certainly heard of people being, you know, awakened in the middle of the night and just shooting bolt upright, you know, with that sort of fight or flight, you know, kind of sense when they wake up. They're tense, and, you know, they might be sweating, and, you know, they might hear a loud sound or something in the house or something like that. But I've never heard of an outlet bursting into flames, but.
Have you had any spooky supernatural attacks like that?
I used to, when I was a kid, I used to put stacks of coins, you know, my spare change. I'd never like lay it out on the dresser. I would put stacks of coins. I'd stack them up on my dresser, and there was always, I put them in one place all the time. And there were a few times where I would, you know, go through my routine of coming in from school or whatever, putting the change in the little stacks. And then when I would come in to go to bed, they'd be moved to other places.
What? Now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah. And, you know, my siblings had similar experiences but we were all, you know, for lack of a better word, we were all trained how to deal with this stuff. We knew that it was probably demonic, and we just took authority over it.
Well, let me tell you about an event I had one time. Me and the wife was deep in the woods in the Ozarks in Arkansas, driving a four-wheeler.
It's pretty country.
Yeah, it is. It's untouched. And the reason is because it was so poor that the civilization's really not got there. And which is great. So we're driving deep in the woods, go across this little bridge, and then we come back, and there were stacks of rocks on the side of this bridge. And then we look down and over into the creek area, and there were stacks of rocks everywhere down there. And I was thinking, there is no way that somebody stacked those rocks. Have you ever tried stacking a rock? It takes extreme patience and just exact right kind of rock. And they were everywhere. There's no way that somebody was able to come down there, some kids or anybody, do that. What do you think happened there?
Hard to say. I mean, it does seem to defy any sort of logical explanation. There certainly may be a supernatural component to it.
Well, I'd say. Well, That'd be my spooky story. You got another spooky story?
Let's
oh, hey,
see.
By the way, you did say something, or I think you said earlier that about people getting pushed down or feeling oppressed or something. That happened to me once too, as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've had several friends, you know, who have had night terrors, you know, who've said that they've had very similar experiences. I myself have never had one, but clearly, you know, it's a real phenomenon. Now the psychiatric community will give their, you know, slant on it through the what, you know, the DSM or whatever, but there must be some sort of supernatural component to it as well. You know, as long standing as it's been around, and you know, as long as it's been associated with this sort of archetypal hag figure, and that, you know, that goes back, you know, centuries if not millennia.
Mm-hmm. You know, I can't dig no hag running around. what is the best weapon to destroy this hag? Spike the geritol? What we gotta do? Hide the depends?
The best weapon is to call on the name of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, whatever, however these demonic manifestations occur. You know, I was reading something just the other day from Joe Jordan, who's a MUFON a member, and he's also a Christian, and he's got hundreds of accounts of people who, you know, were in a potential alien abduction scenario, and he said it's just amazing when these people call on the name of Jesus, these things leave, they flee.
Mm-hmm. I have never once in all these thousands of interviews I have done, have I ever heard somebody say they call in the name of Allah? It seems like all you get, you call the name of Allah, all you get is a rock. You know,
yeah.
Nothing big ever happens there. But the name, mm-hmm, of Jesus does seem to be, and even atheistic MUFON people will tell you that Jesus' name stops abductions. And
yeah,
of course they don't like saying that because they don't like getting involved in spiritual matters anyway. They don't like anybody in, sure, the organization that's spiritual.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, clearly, you know, again, if we're trying to quantify all of this, quantify the supernatural, if such a thing is possible, there's more evidence right there. There is compelling evidence that these things are demonic, you know, but they're taking these different forms. And that's why I called, you know, whether it's vampires or werewolves or what have you, that's why I called this new program that I'm offering through the Institute Preternatural Morphology, because the preternatural part is supernatural. The morphology is the form. That's the study of the form that these demons take.
Is Nancy Pelosi a manifestation of the hag spirit?
Well, you know, all joking aside, yes, in many ways. Clearly, she's not operating with a humane trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she clearly doesn't have much common sense.
Yeah, she's not all there.
You know, and she has her peers, you know, in the hallowed halls of Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Burton, we're near the end of the broadcast here. Let's go ahead and check in with our Edge poll. As you know, we have two polls up there regarding tonight's interview with you. One's the monster poll. The other is a demonic activity poll. So let me just go over here and see how the people voted. So for the what monster are you most worried about? The results say it's still a tie. It started at the beginning of the broadcast. It's a tie between the Dog Man and Nutcrackers. And then it's like a five-way tie between werewolves, shadow people, the X. Whew, there's a monster right there. Incubus, succubus, and ghost. So now let's go to the second poll relating to this broadcast. Demonic activity. Is demonic activity increasing? And let's get the results on that. And I stuck demons stole the election, which would prove increasing demonic activity. But second then is yes. demons everywhere, and while there may be some demons that are just mean evil people, in the final minutes of the broadcast, Doctor, how can we discern and know if somebody is even human and not a demon manifesting as a human?
Well, before you go into battle, you have to have preparation. And that in this case, that involves biblical study and not just cherry picking verses. It involves vast amounts of prayer, and it involves discernment, which is given by the Holy Spirit. So these three things have to be in place in order for a person to do that. And you throw in, acumen that you learn from other disciplines, and a peppering of common sense, and you have a formula for being able to make those discernments. But the three that I mentioned the first time, the first part, those are the most important.
Okay. Well, Dr. Jud Burton, I appreciate you coming back on the Edge Television broadcast. Can we have you back again sometime?
Absolutely. I love coming on your show, Daniel.
Right on. Any final thoughts for the folks?
Well, people can email me at professorburton@yahoo.com, burtonbeyond.com, tioba.org, and I've got this new 12-course module, which is basically studying monsters and the demonic, called the Preternatural Morphology. It's on sale right now for $175.
Wow. And the easiest way to get that is through your website?
Yeah, you can probably the best way is to email me first.
Email you first,
and,
okay.
And we'll get you registered.
Okay. And folks, don't forget to subscribe to his YouTube channel. All right, Dr. Burton, I appreciate you coming on the broadcast. Keep your salt, silver bullets, and cross and holy water handy, because you may come across a monster sometime.
You might.
All right. Bye-bye.